Thank you for the invitation. This has been it's been great to be a part of this community for the last 4 weeks and to hear a little bit of the kinds of things that Westminster is, the ways that you all are participating in mission in our presbytery and in our city. And so, yeah, this has been a really good experience for me as well to just be placed a little bit more here in Pittsburgh and understand sort of what's going on. So, so we have, I've framed these last 4 weeks around the metaphor of eat what is set before you out of Luke 10, that there's something fundamental in mission that is, that as we go out into the world, or as we are sent by Christ in the Spirit into God's world, that we learn or discover what mission is about, not sort of behind closed doors in strategy sessions, but rather around tables and among neighbors and among the people to whom God sends us. That mission is something we learn as we go, rather than study and then strategize about. And I think there's there's significant implications for that, not just when we think about overseas mission, but primarily when we think about our own lives and our own neighborhoods and the kinds of relationships that we have on an ongoing basis, that God calls all of God's people to participate in mission. So let me hand these out here, and then... oh, thank you. So I want to begin today. Oh, there's my notes. Yeah, actually that's from like 2 weeks ago. All right, I want to begin today with a story. George Saunders. He mostly writes short stories. He has a book of short stories called The 10th of December, and in his story, The 10th of December. He tells the story of a young boy and an old man on the 10th of December, somewhere in the north, where the 10th of December is a relatively cold time of year. The young boy is a boy who is picked on, and we find out he's picked on, and he's. He doesn't have a lot of friends, and he's running all by himself through a park, through the snow, and it's one of these kinds of days that are hovering right around freezing. You know, there's snow, but it's soft. There's, you know, water dripping from the trees, this kind of day. And the boy is running through the park, and he's imagining himself as a warrior, like many boys do at, you know, this kind of 10, 11-year-old, you know, sort of stage. And he's protecting this popular girl in his class, in his imagination, from, you know, some insidious evil forces. And so he's running through the woods, you know, fighting, you know, with his ninja tricks or whatever, imaginary bad people, all trying to get to the princess, to rescue the princess. Well, the old man is also walking through the park at the same time and doesn't see the boy, but the old man is also engaged in his own kind of heroic, in his own mind, heroic activity. You see, he's dying of cancer, and as the story unfolds, you begin to realize that this man has snuck out of his house when his wife was away. And as he's walking through the woods with the intention of walking until he collapses and committing suicide out in the woods. And he figures this is the way to care for his family, because he has a memory of his own father dying and remembers that his own father turned nasty on his family in his final days. And he's committed to not putting his wife and his children through the nastiness of death. And so he's just going to take his own life. He's going to suffer privately, quietly. And so The old man gets to a point at the edge of a lake, and he decides to take off his winter coat there. And so he takes off his winter coat and then sets it down on this bench facing a frozen lake, and then begins walking around the edge of the lake, continuing to think about his own act of heroism and reflecting on his life and reflecting on his loved ones, and, you know, works his way around the lake. He gets to a hill now around the backside of the lake, and then begins climbing up the hill, and he sees a rock where he thinks that's probably the place where he's going to stop. And so he climbs his way up to the rock and he sits down, and he's shivering now. He's so cold, and he's looking down over the lake and he's shivering, and he thinks, this is it. And then right about at that moment, he realizes that this is perhaps not the way to love and care for his family. He begins regretting the decision that he made, but he also recognizes he's too far gone. You know, he's lost feeling in his fingertips, and he can't stop himself from shivering, and he's just so tired. He just wants to sleep. Well, right around this time, the young boy, as he's winding his way through the woods, gets to the edge of this lake, and suddenly he sees a winter coat there, and he looks at. He sees a winter coat, and he picks up the winter coat, and then he sees footprints in the snow, and he starts. So he starts. You know, he thinks somebody's without a coat, and so, you know, he can play the hero in real life, and so he picks up the coat and he starts following the footsteps. And then as he gets a little bit further down the lake, he can see way up ahead of him a man in short sleeves sitting on a rock. And he thinks, you know, this man's going to freeze to death if I don't get him his coat. And so the young boy sees the shortest path to the man across the lake and begins running across the lake. Now the old man, while he's thinking about his fingertips and thinking about his life, and thinking about his family, suddenly sees this little child running across a lake carrying his coat. And he sees in front of the child a soft spot in the lake. And he thinks, no, child, no, no. And before he knows it, suddenly the kid disappears in the black spot in the middle of the lake. And so the old man springs to life and he goes racing down the hill. Can't feel his feet, can't feel his hands, but he's fully barreling down the hill now. And he gets to the shore, and the ice is all broken up, and he can't find where the child is. He starts wading out into the water, and he still doesn't know where the child is. And then he turns, and he looks, and there's a small body face down on the shore. The child managed to scramble into the shore. And so the old man goes over to the child and starts taking off his wet clothing, and the old man takes off his clothing, takes off his shirt, and takes off his pants, and wraps the child in the clothing, and then with everything he has, he tries to pick the child up and starts staggering through the snow as the child is sputtering and breathing, but, you know, he's not sure. His skin's pink. And after a couple steps, the man collapses and picks the child up again and takes a few more steps and then collapses. And they're working their way through the woods when suddenly the child kind of springs to life and looks at this man, this half-naked old man next to him, and has no idea how he got there. And so the child then just and then realizes he's wearing clothes he doesn't recognize, and the kid just takes off through the woods, running back towards home. And the old man takes a couple more steps and then just sinks into the snow. After a couple minutes, the old man finds himself in a warm car with a woman trying to bring him back to consciousness. And the car is weaving through the streets, and then he finds himself in a living room, covered in blankets, again with this woman tending to him, who's scolding him and then scolding her child. Must be. Scolding him and then scolding her child. And after, warming up and feeling coming back into his fingertips and into his feet and taking, sips of warm water, his wife comes and takes him home. Now, this George Saunders story, I think, is profound on a whole variety of levels. I can't read the story. Should we do this instead?
I think we'll switch, if that's
great.
Okay with you. There you go. Sorry about that.
No worries. Now, this George Saunders story, I think, is profound on a whole variety of levels. I can't read the story without weeping by the end. It's told beautifully. But what I think is perhaps most profound about it as a sort of just a narrative is the fact that here are two people who are heroes in their own minds. The boy is playing hero in this imaginary world. And the man, the old man, is acting out of his own sense of heroism, of the autonomous, solitary cowboy, bravely falling on his sword. Okay, I've just changed metaphors, but you get what I mean. Bravely taking his own life to spare suffering for those around him. And yet, as the reader, you recognize the foolishness of these acts of heroism. The boy isn't saving anyone. The boy, is suffering on a variety of levels, and he's imagining this heroism as a way of escaping it. And the old man is, you imagine as you're reading this story of the old man, the man's family, finding him in the woods. And how is this an act of care? And yet, by the end of the story, they are heroes. But they're heroes in their... they're heroes in their suffering rather than heroes in their activism or in their power. They're heroes in their passion or their passivity, in a sense, rather than heroes in their activity. The boy becomes a hero. The boy saves the man by falling into the lake. The man had been resolved to the fact that he was going to die on that rock. And having this boy in need brought, him into something that he didn't think he was capable of. The boy saves the man by falling into the lake, but the man saves the boy by rushing to his aid and getting his wet clothes off. And then the boy saves the man by rushing to his mother, who found him, the story tells us, found him when he came running out of the park wearing somebody else's clothes. And I think there's something profound communicated in a profound way about what it means to be human in this story. I think in our Western imagination, we imagine our humanity in terms of autonomy and in terms of power and in terms of agency. What it means to be a person is to be an agent. What it means to be important is to be powerful. Be autonomous. And yet, if we think about it for more than 30 seconds, we realize that a key part of what it means to be human is to be dependent, to be in relationship to receive. We receive our humanity and we even receive our agency and our power through others. We are dependent upon others in early life, and we are dependent on others in late life, and the time in between, we just kid ourselves. And so I want to suggest to you that this picture of what it means to be human ought to be part of what guides our thinking about how we participate in the mission of God. There's a tendency, I think, in mission literature, in mission history, to think about mission in what I call the heroic missionary narrative. You know, I was working with, in research I was doing with a congregation in an urban setting several years ago. This heroic missionary narrative came to me when I was doing research in a congregation in an urban neighborhood. And I remember we were doing interviews across the congregation, and I was studying how people thought and experienced, how people reflected theologically, we might say, on their partnerships with a variety of civil society organizations. And at the top of one, I didn't ask any questions in the interviews, and I had actually people in the congregation go do interviews. So I was—it was a kind of like an applied ethnography. At the top of one of the interview forms that was turned back to me, somebody wrote, "Nobody has done more for this church." The interviewee wants us to know that nobody has done more for this church than Pastor Chad. And there were a couple others that said things similarly. So I started asking questions about who this Pastor Chad is. Well, Pastor Chad was the youth minister. And he was, at this time, he was probably mid-40s, had been at the church for like right out of like college or seminary, like mid-20s or whatever. So he'd been there almost 20 years by this point. And he had a van. And when the church was primarily old and white, his youth ministry was very diverse and active, and 40 or so kids from the city that, you know, refugees and immigrants and African-American kids and white kids and rich kids and poor kids. I mean, it was just this beautiful picture of the neighborhood, the demographics of the neighborhood around the church. When the rest of the church didn't look anything like the neighborhood, his youth group looked very much like the neighborhood. And kids all across the city knew Pastor Chad. And he would, on Wednesday nights, get in his van and then, like, for 20 years, just drive through the city, just picking kids up on street corners, you know, and bringing them to youth group. The church was extremely proud of their youth ministry, extremely proud of Pastor Chad. But almost none of the people that I talked with about Pastor Chad had ever been on a Wednesday night to even observe this youth ministry. They loved the stories, and they loved to pay Pastor Chad a salary and send Pastor Chad to go do his work. And they could say, hey, we're the church that has the thriving city urban youth ministry. There was also a pastor named Shana, who's the children's ministry pastor. And the church throughout the week, you know, 5 days a week, was full of kids, again, of diverse group of kids that would come for tutoring. And some were a part of the daycare and after school care. And I mean, the church was hopping with kids all throughout the week. And the connection point between these neighborhood kids and the church was Pastor Shana. And so they would brag about Pastor Shana, what a wonderful minister she is, and how amazing it is that she's so connected with the neighborhood. But the population on a Sunday morning was not the population on a Tuesday afternoon. You see, within mission history and within our congregations now, there's this sense of what I would call the heroic missionary narrative. This sense that God calls certain people that are just a little bit more heroic than the rest of us to go do on our behalf what we could never do. The single, solitary, brave missionary that goes where no woman or man has gone before. And frankly, a lot of the modern missionary movement has been premised on this idea of the heroic missionary. I mean, a lot of our missionary biographies. You know, I remember as a kid getting those. Can't think of what they're called now. It's a whole series. It's gone. It's not going to come back. But there's a whole series of these missionary biographies focused on individuals that have done, you know, the Jim Elliots and, that have gone into the jungles and, you know, sacrificed mightily for the gospel and, and then encouraging kids to think, well, maybe you could be a hero too. Maybe you could be a heroic missionary too. Now, this idea of the heroic missionary emerges out of certain structural elements of what we would call the modern missionary movement. And I think these structural elements haven't just affected our overseas mission, but have also affected how we think about local mission. So that it just seems natural for us in our congregations to think that there's certain heroes that we're going to send, and we're going to send them in this certain way. And that our job is to primarily be senders. And the hero's job is primarily to be the hero. And so when congregations think about overseas mission and when they think about local mission, they're worried about where are we going to get the money and who are the heroes. So let me back up just a bit and talk about, you know, the roots of the heroic missionary narrative. In a very kind of gross and generic sense, not gross as in disgusting, but gross as in just broad, in a really generic sense, the modern missionary movement, you know, historians will sometimes just point to Jim Carrey. Not Jim Carrey, William Carrey. Jim Carrey's another story. Okay, William Carrey. So William Carrey was a Baptist shoemaker in England in the late 1700s who grew frustrated with the seeming inability of London organizations to adequately send missionaries into the field. So this is a time of growing kind of colonial power. Growing awareness of the broader world and the diversity in the world, and growing kind of evangelical fervor around evangelism, but also around issues of justice and other things as well. And so William Carey wrote a little tract called An Inquiry into the Obligation to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen. I love that in older times, titles were so descriptive, you know? Like, you can't fit that on the spine of a book. So the tract that he wrote, you know, it begins by saying the missionary, you know, looking at things like Matthew 28 and some of these evangelistic texts and saying that there's an obligation upon the church to preach the gospel, and that the work of mission is not complete. You know, the whole world has not heard of the gospel. And then the next part of the book is using the best data that Carey could gather together, a tracking of all the different people groups in the world, or at least the ones that they knew of in kind of the growing British Empire. And talking about how, you know, all the terrible things that happen in these parts of the world, and then what their primary religion is, and then how many people that are roughly in this part of the world don't know, have never heard the gospel. And, you know, as you read it, I mean, there's a lot of ways that we now, with modern sort of eyes, we will look at it and say, boy, it's denigrating of other people groups, and there's all kinds of problems with what Carey's doing. But even now, you read it, and you get this overwhelming sense of the world is so big, and there's so much that perhaps the churches in the West can do. And then Carey, at the end of the book, makes an argument that the same mechanisms that have enabled companies like the Hudson Bay Company and some of these other organizations that have thrived under the growing British Empire, the same mechanisms that have helped these companies to thrive could be leveraged to send missionaries. When a company wants to start work in another part of the world, they collect capital. They raise capital. And they raise capital from a variety of interested parties. And then that capital gets pooled together, and it gets, it makes possible, you know, this building of a bridge and you know, sending people or representatives from the company to go act on the company's behalf. And Kerry simply says, why can't interested people themselves raise capital and send people to the parts of the world that we feel called? Why do we need to work through existing church structures and all of this kind of stuff? So, you know, he's investigating the obligation to use means for evangelism. And so Kerry writes this book, he raises some money, and he sends himself to India, where he spends the rest of his life. Now, there was a lot of other missionary activity happening at the time, but what's significant about Kerry is, and why people will call him kind of the beginning of the modern missionary movement, is because he introduces a technology that makes mission suddenly much more accessible for people that aren't, you know, filtered through the hierarchy of the church. The mission historian Andrew Walls says that, you know, William Carey is God's theological joke played on people who knew better. You know, there's no theological rationale for the Voluntary Missionary Society. There's no ecclesial or churchly sort of rationale for this. This wasn't a theological argument. Because the church is this way and because mission is this way, then therefore we ought to. It was a practical argument. It was an argument into the use of means. It was the introduction of a technology. Interested people can volunteer their time, their money, themselves, and go. And so what results from this, is it's not just that singular volunteers can go, but that, you know, we can raise money to send our own people. You know, so a variety of mission societies raise up that are not just linked to church denominational structures, but are linked to a variety of causes. And people don't need to be ordained to go any longer. People don't need to have theological training to go any longer. There's the capacity for a massive amount of missionary activism, and business people with business acumen get drawn into the missionary movement. You know, people that can make things happen. Anyway, what results? And so, you know, the three things that I have up here are, you know, it makes it possible for individuals to go. It makes it possible. Capital funds can be raised by individuals rather than churches. And then finally, it makes possible a division of labor, in the sense that after Kerry and even up until now, a lot of our language around mission is that not everybody can go, but the hero can go. And then the job for those of us that aren't heroes is to give money so the hero can go. And that sort of efficient division of labor that's not theological, but it's practical, and it kind of makes things happen, I think has carried on with us today. And so, you know, I'm observing in this church, as I'm doing research, the fact that their language is still out of this heroic kind of missionary, Pastor Shana and Pastor Chad. They are the ones that are gifted and sent to connect with our neighborhood. And the job of the rest of us is just to keep funding them so that they can go. Some of us pay and some of us go. Now, I think that there's several problems with this narrative. And as throughout mission history, there's been objections raised to a purely kind of pragmatic or technological approach to mission. Just because you can raise the funds
and send somebody without training or whatever doesn't mean you should, or doesn't mean it's the best thing. And I think the missionary movement, the modern missionary movement, has grown up quite a bit since then. And there are kind of best practices that voluntary missionary societies largely abide by. However, the narrative out of which this operates is still, I think, deeply within us. And so what I want to offer is both a theological and a practical challenge to this heroic missionary narrative. Theologically, I think this is a narrative that when we think that there's some that are sent to go and the rest of us are meant to support, I think it leads us. What's the right word for this? I think it challenges. It leads us to a view of mission. Let me start here. It leads us to a view of mission that is incomplete. And then I think it also leads us to a way of acting missionally that tends to imagine mission in terms of power rather in terms of presence. It imagines mission in terms of a project rather than a kind of presence among. So let me develop some of the theological argument and then move to the practical and what that means for us. So the term Missio Dei, is popular right now in terms of thinking about mission and missional church and all this kind of stuff. And my guess is you've heard that term get thrown around quite a bit. It's a way of framing mission. You know, it means mission of God, and it's a way of framing mission that really has kind of come into our consciousness in the second half of the 20th century. And it emerges at a time when the missionary movement that I just described was really at a crisis point. So if you want to think in terms of broad sketches, William Carey begins the modern missionary movement. And the modern missionary movement is characterized by tons of of activism and projects building of systems and raising of money and sending of people. And, you know, it's all kind of interconnected with the colonial project in ways that were sometimes intentional, a lot of times unintentional. It's not fair to paint this all with one big broad brushstroke and say they were all colonialists, but it's also not fair to say they were all just doing really noble work either. I mean, it's a complicated, ambiguous history and often with unintended consequences. Right around early 1900s, the missionary movement is kind of this global, ecumenical, kind of work. You have a missionary conference in 1910 in Edinburgh, and there's so much optimism at this time. You know, one of the catchphrases is the evangelization of the world in this generation. There's this sense that, you know, the Western churches were so powerful. Technology had made travel and communication so much better. There was so much money and energy put into mission that there really was this sense that within the next generation, we can evangelize the entire world. Well, we all know shortly after 1910, Europe is just embroiled in an awful, pointless war. And in a lot of ways, the optimism and the progressivism and the hope of the missionary movement dies in the trenches of World War I. And most of the 20th century is then the Western churches trying to, you know, trying to figure out how we might still meaningfully engage in mission, sort of after the struggle, you know, the after World War I, and then the malaise up to World War II, and then the Holocaust and World War II. I mean, any claim that the Western Church had to superiority, to kind of moral superiority, to being Christendom, I mean, all of this gets called into question by the events of the first half of the 20th century. And so by 1950, 1960, you start having independence movements in former colonies. And what happens with these independence movements is that missionary agencies get booted out in some cases. And indigenous national churches, are sometimes left without support from the West suddenly. You have the closing of China. In the rise of communism in China, missionaries get kicked out and China is closed. And China was the kind of jewel of the modern missionary movement in a lot of ways. And so the 1950s and 60s are a point of major crisis for Western mission agencies. Not only are we not as good as we thought we were, but we're also not nearly as Christian as we thought we were. At the same time, as mission agencies are getting kicked out of countries, there's this sense of malaise in the Western church that really kind of, you know, we become aware of in the 1960s, and we're now exceptionally aware of, you know, now. But what happens, and so there's this kind of crisis in global mission that happens, and out of this crisis, there's a turn back to theology of mission, asking the question, why should we engage in mission in the first place? And the term Missio Dei really comes out of this sense of crisis. This sense of we've been so good at accomplishing things and building things and sending people that we have, and yet we have been largely, in the end, ineffective. Or we've been morally implicated in colonialism and a variety of other things. So Missio Dei comes about because of a recognition, a rereading of the biblical texts that begins to say, actually, the church is not about missions in the sense of the things that we do and the projects that we have, but rather mission is about God, about who God is. And the conversation has shifted from a theology enforcing the ways that the church might engage in mission, rather to beginning with a theology and recognizing that mission comes out of who God is. So part of the rationale for this, the term mission, you know, in the biblical part of the rationale for this, came out of the Trinitarian theology of Karl Barth and Karl Rahner. Barth had a way of framing God's revelation as saying when God reveals God's self would be one of the common refrains. You know, God is the revealer, God is the content of the revelation, and God is, at sort of the front and the back of any revealing moment. God reveals God's own self. And Barth's rationale for that was a Trinitarian rationale, in the sense that, God is... it's a Trinitarian rationale in the sense that the life of Father, Son, and Spirit is a life that is open for our participation in it. We come to know God through participating in the divine life. God makes God's own life available to us. We don't reach for God, but God, in a sense, reaches and includes us. So the Mishnah's Missio Dei, you know, begins with mission originates with and leads to the triune God. And then secondly, that mission reveals God's nature as love. And by rooting mission in the life of God, that mission exists because God is a missionary God. The Father sends the Son. The Father and Son send the Spirit. And that in the life of Father and Son, Father sending Son and Father and Son sending Spirit, it's in this life, the triune life, that reveals the nature of mission. So the Missio Dei is trying to make the claim that any understanding we have of mission is an understanding that is rooted, first of all, in the character of God's life, in the life of Father, Son, and Spirit. And so, you know, in the crisis of mission, as the West has become more self-conscious of our own kind of moral inadequacy when it comes to mission, it's led to a kind of reflection on if mission originates with God, then what does God's own life and God's own character reveal about mission itself? And I think it makes a difference, starting with our reflection of mission, on reflecting, thinking about mission as originating in God. It makes a difference because I think it avoids, it helps us avoid, it helps us avoid mission as a project, and helps us think about mission more in much more relational terms. Let me give a couple examples. So this is anybody know what movie this is from? So this is the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, and I think there's a Taken 2 also. And so this is, you know, it's a very typical American action-style film. Liam Neeson has a daughter who is in France and gets kidnapped by an underground human trafficking, you know, kind of organization. Liam Neeson hears his daughter's talking to him on her phone. He hears her get taken. The phone is left in the room, and the kidnapper picks up the phone, and Liam Neeson says, "Let her go." He's a former CIA agent. And Liam Neeson says, "Let her go." And the guy laughs, and Liam Neeson says, "Let me tell you something." He says, "I am a person with a particular set of skills that make me a nightmare to people like you. I will find you, I will track you down, and I will kill you." He says something like that. And then the guy laughs and hangs up the phone. Well, you know where the rest of the movie is. Neeson gets on a plane, he flies over to France, and the entire rest of the movie is Liam Neeson killing and beating up person after person after person after person until he finally rescues his daughter and brings her home. And, you know, as a viewer, you feel like all of this violence is perfectly justified. I mean, the movie, in a sense, manipulates you or frames the story in such a way that, of course, these people deserve to be shot because they're bad and Liam is good and his daughter was taken. And the only way to deal with evil is to snuff it out, to kill it. Now, movies like this operate on, you know, what we might call an ontology of violence. This sense that the world is, or existence is, at core conflictual and violent. That there's good and there's evil, and the two are engaged in epic battle against one another, and the only way to deal with evil is to snuff it out, to kill before you are killed. Most of our movies operate with some version of this ontology. There's a scene early in the movie that convinces you that this person's cause is superior to that person's cause, and therefore now any means is necessary for good to triumph over evil. And you cheer every time the bad guy gets killed until the princess is rescued. Now, a Trinitarian theology invites us to think very differently about the world and about the creation of the world. That in the beginning was not conflictual violence out of which we have emerged. And at the core, existence is not good versus evil in equal measures. But rather, Trinitarian theology has us see creation as God, as Father, Son, and Spirit, a communion. A God is love, we say. And out of God's love, the world is created. Out of love of Father, Son, and Spirit, humanity is created. And the human being is created as a participant. You know, God gifts Adam and Eve, not with dominion in the sense of standing over creation, which is sometimes how we've interpreted 1:26, Genesis 1:26, but rather as a participant, as a co-laborer, as a co-gardener with God in God's creation. To be human is to participate in the God's, to be a co-caregiver with God in God's creation. And so I think framing mission within the triune life helps us to see mission is not God's conquering of the other in converting, you know, the heathen to God. Mission is not the church's marching onward Christian soldiers out into the world. But mission is rather an expression of God's character, which we know through triune reflection is non-coercive love. For what is the triune life and what is love if we look to God? Love is not the smothering of the other. It's not the snuffing out of the other. It's relationship that allows the other to flourish. And to love in the end is to suffer the other, to be open to being hurt by the other. And so the picture of God that we get all throughout the biblical story, I mean, yes, there's, I'm not going to deal right now with some of the judgment passages. We can do that maybe later. But, you know, the overwhelming picture of God in relationship to God's people and God in relationship to God's creation is, as Walter Brueggemann would say, God commits God's self to creation in freedom and in passion. God is God, and so therefore God is free. And God doesn't have to do anything. And yet God's relationship with God's creatures is one of passion, marked by passion. And so God in Hosea, you know, says, I had thought you would have repented by now. You know, God is as the wounded lover in that text. And if we want to know God's character in relationship to creation, as Christians, we look to the cross. Again, cross is an event within the life of God. God's suffering in solidarity with this, with sinful humanity in a fallen world. All of this to say, if mission originates with God and it's an expression of God's character, then the calling of the church in relationship to God's world is, it can't be one of conquering. It can't be one of insisting upon our way. But rather one of learning to love the other. And in love, allowing the other to flourish. And in love, allowing the other at times to hurt us or wound us. To be in solidarity, to be affected by, to be vulnerable with the other. There's two different, you know, pictures of the Trinity that I think are... you know, anytime we try to conceptualize the Trinity, there's a whole variety of problems with this. So I offer these not as this is how we should think about the Trinity and therefore mission, but rather here's two different visual representations that I think invite us into a profound reflection. So the one on the left is Blake's sketch of the Trinity. And so there you have the wings of the Spirit, you know, the Spirit that broods, that hovers over the waters at creation. The Spirit like a dove, but here looking more like an eagle, you know, hovering over the Father who is cradling the Son. And so there's, you know, an image of the cross, right? The God's solidarity with sinful humanity through the Son on the cross. With the Spirit hovering over. Mission is this God's commitment to opening the life, God's life up for the sake of a fallen and broken world. The one on the right is Rublev's icon of the Trinity. And this was a really, you know, kind of famous icon. But you have here, you know, if you notice, you can't necessarily tell who the Father is in this one. There's a sense of equality among the three, which is slightly different than sometimes we've been trained to think about the Trinity in the West. But you know that the Father's there because the Son and the Spirit are nodding their heads. They're bowing their heads towards the one on the left. You have in the middle a cup, the cup of suffering, the blood of Christ, God suffers the sin of the world in the life of God. You know that the Son is the one in the middle because there's two fingers on the table for Christ's two natures. You know, God and man. And, you know, the Spirit is on the right because the Spirit, the hand of the Spirit is down. In a sense, the Spirit is the Creator Spirit, the one at work in sustaining all creation. You have a tree in the background, which is a reference to the Trinity, the cross. And then you have at the front an open seat. And that open seat is meant to invite you, the viewer, to the table. And this is in the Orthodox tradition, salvation is theosis. It's participation in the divine life. It's Athanasius says God became man so that man might become, you know, like God. This invitation that salvation is to be at the around the table. To be invited into the triune life. And again, when we say God is love, these are pictures that can help us for what that looks like. God's love doesn't conquer us, but woos us, invites us into participation in the divine life. God's love in the church, through the church, is not a love that conquers our neighbors or sends out, you know, the hero on our behalf to, you know, vanquish evil or get people into the fold, but rather is a means by which God's love through us is a means by which we then invite others to our table or sit at the table with others, that we might be co-suffering, participate in the co-suffering love of God. So, where does this all go practically? I want to suggest that a mission theology rooted in an understanding of the Trinity, that Father, Son, and Spirit revealed the character of mission, and that mission originates from God and leads back to God. It's not the project of the church. I want to suggest that one of the primary steps that we take then, initially, as we learn to live and participate in God's mission, is that we learn to develop what a friend of mine calls bicultural bridge communities. Mission takes place not by sending individuals, but by the church learning to build bridges with companions and partners of God's mission in our neighborhoods, in our communities, with our global partners. That it's about mission emerges, or we discover what God's mission looks like by building bridges and by being in communities of shared practice and shared life and shared concern. And to do this means that we have to let go of a whole variety of ideas that we might have about what we think God wants us to do. Let me give an example. When I was a pastor in Vancouver, we had a woman in our church named Marlene, who was she was a refugee from Peru, and her visa status, because of some complication with the Canadian government, they had been uncertain of their status, her and her family, for 2 years. And at the time, she's now just recently been granted status, which we were really, really happy about. But after being in Canada for about a year, still with uncertain status, she came to me and told me, we had met her through, we were doing a ministry with refugees in our neighborhood, and she came to me and she told me, Pastor Scott, my daughter's being bullied, and I want to do a community art project on anti-bullying. And I said, that sounds great, Marlene. How can I help? And she said, well, I have this letter that I'm writing to the city of Burnaby to ask for a grant to do this project, and could you proofread it for me? And I said, sure, I can proofread it for you. So I proofread it and give it back to her, and then she sends it in. And I'm thinking, she's not going to get the money, so this isn't going to cost me anything. Well, she got the money. But she got the money under the stipulation that she needed a nonprofit organization to sort of manage the money. Because what she had proposed is she wanted to do a public art mural in the park right by her house, which was a large immigrant population, a public mural that sort of celebrates the diversity of the neighborhood. And then she wanted to do a festival to celebrate the mural. Now, I hadn't really read the letter carefully enough to know, to track this forward, to say if this goes, I'm like not committing myself to proofreading. I'm like committing a whole lot of time to something, right? So she gets the money, and then she says, well, now to do the festival, I'm going to need to raise more money. And so, Pastor Scott, could you help me pull people together from the neighborhood that we could, you know, raise money and get other people involved? Before long, this thing becomes this monster that I've totally lost control of, and I have no time for it. I don't even... It sounds like a great idea now, but at the time I'm thinking, this isn't going to work. This is a terrible idea. I could do this so much more efficiently. But Marlena was driving it. And so, you know, I find myself at a regular basis leading up to this festival at these meetings of neighborhood constituency, you know, constituent members of the neighborhood, led by... A South American woman with a lot of her South American friends that run meetings stylistically very different than I, as a white Western male, would run these meetings. And, I mean, they're full of passion and tears, and, I mean, they go on for hours sometimes, and it doesn't feel like we're getting anything done. And I'm the one responsible to sort of distribute this money, and I'm the one that has to write the report back to the city to say, yes, we spent the money in X, Y, and Z, and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was a disaster. I was frustrated with it. I thought it was a terrible idea. I had a bad attitude about it. I thought, I could do this so much better. I know this neighborhood. I do events all the time. All this kind of stuff. Well, the day came, and we had 1,500 people. We had multiple partners from the neighborhood, food donated from all these different places. We had all these different ethnic dance groups perform throughout the day. We had, you know... It was amazing. The city comes to it, and the city says, okay, next year... We're going to give, like, they, like, doubled or tripled their commitment. And the only thing is you need a nonprofit to sponsor you. And so we did it the next year. And it was just as frustrating and just as maddening. And our church got no credit for it other than, like, Southside Community Church on the bottom. You know, Neighborhood Inclusion Festival, Southside Community Church. I mean, like, so, like, there was no strategic, rational, whatever. We had 3,000 people the next time. And, you know, I mean, it was amazing. But the participation in mission at that moment for me was, a lot of it was about suffering Marlena's ideas and energy and agency, and letting Marlena flourish as a human being and letting her create the kind of community that only she could create. But she still needed us to help. But not in the way that we would have preferred, which is we're in charge, we're up front, we get the credit for it. We get to control the messaging. And in the process, there was this bicultural bridge community of co-suffering. I'm sure Marlena could tell the story and talk about how maddening it was to work with Pastor Scott. I think these are the kinds of partnerships, when we talk about companionship, mission as a kind of participation companionship, of building partnerships, of developing rhythms of shared life together, bicultural bridge communities. This is what God's mission invites us into. And it's not just one of us to go on behalf and conquer in the name of Jesus, but it's all of us learning to live in our communities in a way that are open to the things that God might be doing, recognizing that the mission of God takes place in a way that is consistent with the character of God, which is about passion and wooing and companionship and solidarity. Now, I'm going to get political for just a second. I think our current political climate, we were just talking in the back before about contempt in our political process right now. I think there's an opportunity for the church to be political, but not in the ways that we've been political perhaps in the past. There's still time for writing letters to Congress people and, you know, sending money and elected office and policies. I mean, that's all still important. But to be political in the sense of developing these kinds of communities at the local level, to develop bicultural bridge communities, to be a people that are active and at work in the world in such a way that point to the character of God, in a way that causes others around us to look and say, what is going on there? That these people might gather, that these people might, these people share in life with one another and suffer one another in such a way. I think there's an opportunity for us, and I think the mission of God is inviting us to be creative and courageous in developing partnerships and discerning companionship with others in the neighborhood. My guess is there's Marlenas in all of our lives that we might pay attention to. Let me pray for us. I think we're at 45. Father God, I give thanks for this church and this community. Thank you for the ways that they are present and active and generous in this city and in this region. Lord, I pray that we might not only be generous in time or in sending others on our behalf, but that you might help us to attend to all the different ways that we are called and sent into relationships of co-suffering love, that we might be responsive to the initiative and the passions and the energy of those around us, that we might help facilitate flourishing in our immediate community and in this region and in our global partnerships as well. Lord, we give thanks for this invitation that you have given us to participate in mission and to be your people. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Sorry I went over. Thank you for the last couple weeks. This has been a lot of fun.